Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. Today's guest is one of the top teachers in the space of relationship. I mean, millions of people consume her content every day because she's incredible. And I'm so excited that I got to sit down with her. She's become a great friend. And what I love so much about her work is this level of accountability that is responsible to create the relationships that you desire and also the life that you desire. And this level of responsibility that we need to take when we want to step towards love in a way that is both intentional, but also from a space of, I'm going to create this. Like, there's not a question. And her work and her new book, It Begins With You, 9 Hard Truths About Love That Will Change Your Life. They're going to change your life. And so in this episode, we talk about those 9 hard truths and who doesn't love a good hard truth, so that we can liberate ourselves and step fully into love, open our hearts up and share them with the people around us and not share them with the people who are not safe to share them with. So with all that said, today's guest, Jillian Turecki. Before we dive in, make sure you hit the like button, the subscribe button, and the notification button so you don't miss any future videos. All right, without further ado, let's go. Jillian Turecki. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. Today I have returning guest, superstar, Jillian Turecki. What's up?
Yo. Hello.
So good to have you. You have such a loungy setup. I like it.
I know. I'm very loungy today.
Yeah. Like, it just looks comfy. You're curled.
Yeah. I want it to be cozy. I know. Well, it's not here. I'm in Miami, but I'm...
Oh, yeah. Never mind.
But I'm channeling, you know, cozy fall vibes.
Listen, I've got snow on the ground, so it matches your experience. Uh-huh. Congrats on the new book.
Thank you.
Are you so excited?
I am. I mean, it was a lot of work, so it's really nice to see it actually come into fruition. Yeah, I am excited. I am.
And it's your first book?
Yeah, very first.
Yeah, it's quite an endeavor, you know? It's the birth of something pretty massive, and to be able to take all of your relationship experience and knowledge and wisdom and compress it into pages of a book is kind of wild, isn't it?
Oh, it's so much wilder than I actually thought it would be, because, you know, so much of writing a book is trying to distill the information.
Yeah.
And deciding, like, what's really important to share and what, you know, should be left out.
Well, and especially because you decided to share 9 hard truths about love.
As opposed to 3.
Yeah, exactly. So for those listening or watching, the book's called It Begins With You, 9 Hard Truths About Love That Will Change Your Life. So why that title and why 9?
It is actually one of my favorite numbers. It kind of always has been. And I was like, is this going to be 3? If this is going to be 5, is this going to be 12? Is it going to be 10? And it just turned out that 9 was the number that of truths that I wanted to share. I mean, yes, there was a part of me was like, can I just make it 9? But I wasn't attached to that.
Yeah.
I titled it Begins With You because that's the first truth, is that it begins with you, because anything that we want to change in our lives, which includes our love lives, it starts with us. It starts with a desire that we have to change. It starts with being able to look in the mirror and see what we need to change, what patterns we need to change, what beliefs we need to change, what we have to develop and cultivate within ourselves. It begins with us because I think that we have so much more influence over the state of our love life, whether we're in a relationship or not, than we give ourselves credit. And I ultimately wanted people to recognize that we're actually much more influential and powerful than we think that we are. And I think, you know, we feel part of what causes so much suffering is to feel so incredibly out of control, because there is so little that we are in control of in this world. But we are actually, we have more say than we think we do, more agency than we believe ourselves to have over the the destiny of our lives and over the destiny of our love lives in particular. And that regardless of what happened to you in childhood or didn't happen in childhood, regardless of your attachment style, with tools and with the right mentorship, and you can, those two things, you can really change the course of your relationship life.
Yeah, that coming back to the reality, which I think is like getting smashed up the side of the head with whatever is very big and hurts a lot. The recognition that nothing changes if we don't change, you know, that if we don't actually say, okay, I remember hearing that idea of like everything in your life got there because you said yes to it.
Yeah.
And that's like a pretty hard thing to accept at first if we've been kind of living in this, like life just happens to me. And life can happen to us, of course, like we could be the victims of experiences. But I think it's this like powerful paradox to hold that life can happen to you. And somehow you got no choice but to clean it up. You know, you got no choice but to do something with what life has handed you.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we all have to deal with, you know, and it's one of the harder realities of life. And I really believe that everything's really dependent on the choices that we make. Like if we're going to bring it back to the state of our love life, it's, you know, who we choose to partner with. And, you know, everything boils down to our choices. We can, you know, love someone and still decide not to, we can be attracted to someone and still decide to not pursue a relationship with them.
Right.
We could have great compassion for someone and decide that we'd no longer want to be within a relationship with them. You know, the quality of our lives are really dependent on the quality of the choices that we make. And, so yeah, a lot of times we're saying yes to the experience. And I think that this personal responsibility is not something, it's not about shame. It's not about blame. It's really, if we want to feel more free and if we want to have better experiences, you know, I'm all for getting help, but no one can get you to the other side of where you want to be. Like your therapist can't do it. Your parents can't do it. Your partner can't do it. Like the onus is really on us. And with the right mentorship, you can do it.
Yeah. And that like all the information in the world is great, but we got to be the ones who apply it. You know, it's like when someone says to me, which I'm sure you hear a lot, is like, thanks so much. You got me through whatever the thing is. And I'm like, I mean, I might have been there alongside you, but you did it. Like,
yeah, you did.
I didn't do it. Like, you did it. And it's so important that you recognize you did it.
Yeah.
And, you know,
that's a very good point.
You know that feeling of like when you're ready to learn something that all of a sudden the book appears, you know? Mm-hmm. So I hope for those of you listening or watching that if there's navigation of relational stuff, I'm such a believer in trusting that the teacher arrives when the student's ready.
And me too.
I could tell you no better teacher than Jillian Turecki. Oh. So Jillian, the second truth, which I'm actually very curious because you maybe left it ominous for me, not for me specifically, but the mind is a battlefield. Truth number two, like, tell us more.
So we are story-making machines, and our minds are not built to make us happy. Our minds are designed, it's like basically software to make us safe. And we live in a very complex world, and it's easy to become extremely neurotic and to get very stuck in our heads and to create all these stories and narratives and meanings. And it doesn't mean that none of the stories are actually true, but we can get very in our heads. And when we're in our heads is when things really start to fall apart in our lives. It's really what sabotages a relationship. Like, for example, two people in a relationship, if they're constantly in their heads, they build up a tremendous amount of resentment. Well, if he really loved me then, or, you know, she did that thing, and so I wonder if it means this or that. And we analyze the other person and we analyze the scenario, and we get so fixated, and we become, you know, some people are amazing storytellers, and we can get very caught up in that, and it becomes a battlefield when we're not communicating. You know, we have in very ancient yogic texts this idea of the monkey mind, which is like the idea of like the monkey swinging from tree to tree or from branch to branch. That's sort of the quality of thoughts. Our thoughts can really bounce around. And if we don't question our thoughts, if we don't question the stories that we have, and we're always believing them, then we're believing in something that's incredibly unreliable, that is only designed to make you feel safe. And even if it's at the detriment of your relationships and of your life. And so we have to be aware of the fact, and we have to recognize, you know, we have to have the shared awareness that the mind, if we don't question it, if we don't question the stories, can get the better of us, and can create a lot of fiction, and then can lead us down a road where we are sabotaging our relationships.
What do you think makes it so that someone can move from... Actually, let me first ask, why do you think it is such a default for the human mind to not recognize that it creates stories, to not recognize that it is making meaning out of all these things and gathering evidence about, you know, if we're upset at our partner, all the evidence of why, even of our own dysfunction, which I think is just so fascinating. It's like you leave childhood maybe believing you're not worthy because your parents didn't show up for you, mm-hmm. or were not reliable, or were abusive, or whatever it might be. But it often takes like a book like this, or like a conversation like we're having,
yeah.
for someone to even think, oh, maybe I'm not a piece of shit. It's that I was treated poorly and I then created that belief. Like, why do you think that's the default for the most part?
The default, you mean to create a negative meaning out of something?
Yeah, and to not be able to differentiate that we are evidence gathering for one thing and not looking for evidence. Of, it's like if you're depressed, you're biased towards, you know, in the research of like people will wish you happy birthday and you won't even gather that evidence.
Right. Well, first of all, it's not universal. I think that there are people who have a habit of defaulting to the most disempowering meaning.
Yeah.
And those people, and I've gotten into habits of that. Typically there would be something else going on in my life, or I wasn't taking care of myself or whatever. But when one is caught up in that habit, that's what leads to unhappiness. Unhappiness is very rarely, although let's, you know, like you said, there are circumstances that do happen in life that definitely make us a victim, but unhappiness rarely has to do with what is happening and what is not happening. It has to do with a state of mind. It's the way we are seeing things. That's why spiritual thought leaders and ancient texts for centuries have been saying, you know, the world is nothing other than what you see it, you know, mm-hmm. as. So some people have a habit of just looking at something and seeing the glass half empty, and creating very negative meanings. So other people have habits the exact opposite. You know, they say, oh, it's all going to work out. Oh, it's all going to work out. Things always work yeah. out. So I don't think it's the default for everyone. But I do think that when we're in a relationship or we're dating, where our egos are most fragile and where we are most emotionally vulnerable, we will have a tendency to go there because it's paradoxically, it's a way that we self-protect.
You know that feeling you get when you crawl into a freshly made bed of silky bedsheets? It's probably my favorite feeling in the world. I've been traveling a lot lately, and every time I go to sleep in another bed, I miss my home. I miss my cozy earth sheets. I gotta tell you, these are the best high-quality sheets I've ever had the pleasure of sleeping on. And even my wife, Kylie, will agree, there are no other sheets that compare. They're soft, they're silky, and so comfortable, and you literally just melt into them. The reason they're so soft is that they're made from viscose from bamboo fabrics, which is softer than cotton, and as a huge bonus, is responsibly and sustainably sourced. On top of that, it's temperature regulating, which means it keeps you cool and comfy all night long, and the unbeatable luxury feel helps turn your bed into the most cozy sanctuary ever. And I'm not the only one who's crazy about them. Cozy Earth has been featured on Oprah's favorite list 7 years in a row. So give their sheets or any of their awesome products a try. They have a 10-year warranty on all their products and a 100-night sleep test to try it for 100 nights. And if you don't love it, you get your money back. But I know you'll love it as much as I do. And they're offering you, my listeners, a massively generous 40% off discount. So go to CozyEarth.com and use Mark at checkout for 40% off all their products. That's CozyEarth.com and use the code Mark for 40% off.
Yeah, that's so true. And the default that we tend to go to, which I would imagine is somehow correlated probably to what we inherit in terms of how our parents see the world. But yes, it's fascinating that you can go from like having the perspective of looking at the world either half empty or half full or whatever it might be. But even for if we're like overtly positive, that could be a reason that we're like actually missing the grittiness of life, the anger, the grief, you know? So it's like we could be too far in one way. But I think, you know, at the essence of what you're saying is to even know that it's happening, is to even know that you could be one or the other, but to even actually explore all these ways in which that you're making meaning in your mind, all the stories you tell. And gosh, with relationships so easy, I have to catch myself constantly when I'm like gathering evidence of some sort of litigation I'm about to bring to my wife about a case I'm going to make about something, you know?
That's very well said. It is sort of like a litigation. Totally. And we do that. And we can work ourselves up and create the story. And then how many times have you thought about, like, you know, a whole scenario before it happened, and you build it up into something so much bigger than it actually is? That's the power of the mind, and that's the mind being a battlefield for sure.
Yeah, so true. And the next truth, which I think is one of those ones that I would never have realized when I was like 22 or something. You know, it's
realize anything at 22.
Yeah. And I often think about, like, when I get asked, like, oh, my partner follows Instagram models or fucking OnlyFans or something. And I'm like, you know what? It wasn't around when I was 22. I for sure would have followed like Instagram models and stuff. I was reading Maxim magazine. Okay.
Well, of course, at 22. But
other
what
people
would you
are
do?
Looking at Wayne Dyer. I was looking at Maxim magazine. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. But what, I mean, so before we get to the truth, what is your take now on grown, mature men, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, on OnlyFans or following a bunch of very clearly provocative accounts where the person is adding no value? They're just, you know, in their bikini all the time. Like, do you think, is it something that you consciously are like, no, I'm choosing not to do that because that's not in alignment with my value system?
Well, I do have to add a qualifier. Is there an inspirational quote in the caption for the bikini picture?
No, there isn't. Let's just say it's just a whole lot of butt. It's a whole lot of ass.
Yeah, the old thirst traps. Look, now I recognize how, one, I don't believe that's honoring my relationship with my wife.
Right.
And two, I don't think it's honoring the actual person, the person that you're engaging with. Like, I think it's an interesting, because for me, I don't think I don't think if your partner says, I'm not comfortable with you following Instagram models, I think you have to ask, is what I'm doing contributing to treating my relationship as sacred or not?
Yeah.
And am I treating another being as sacred? You know, it's like pornography. You know, whenever anyone talks about sexual empowerment and all that kind of stuff, I'm like, I get it that we're like undoing the power structures of inherited, you know, that men exploit power for sex and women exploit sex for power. And it's the, you know, as Esther calls it, the oldest trading system in human history. And if there is a way that you move up the power chain by exploiting sexuality, I just think if we're going to call out the exploitation of power, what about the conversation about the exploitation of sex when it's done consciously?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think like actually engaging in it, you become a consumer of it, which I think is really, I think it's out of integrity with ourselves, but I think it's actually contributing to someone else being out of integrity with their own being while taking into account that for survival, some people have to do those things.
Yeah. It's a nuanced conversation for sure.
Yes. Cause if you go explicitly one way or the other in a conversation like that, it's like all of a sudden you're canceled.
Yeah.
So add all disclaimers, PS, PS, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I don't think so that it's a healthy thing to do. What do you think?
No, I think, you know, I think that we have to exercise some level of self-control. And for me, like that's important for me in a man that he has some level of self-control over that part of his nature.
I think it would be very attractive, you know, like if I'm dating and the woman follows a bunch of like, I don't even know what the equivalent would be. What would be
I
the
know, because women like are not the same. They're not as and they're not visual the same way that men are.
But if I could see that she had an account that was very
much that she's putting it all out there and wanting that validation from others.
That's it. It's like if someone's whole feed is selfies, I'm like, no, get a friend to take your picture. Like you got, and it also starts to see how, like I've seen in profiles where someone, if you scroll up, you can see where they started to become more sexual and then they got more engagement. And so there's still this really fascinating, like we're still doing it for affirmation. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of thoughts on all of this, but
I know.
Get to the actual truth that you speak of, which I think is very correlated, is lust is not the same thing as love.
Mm-hmm.
That is really hard to differentiate. Cause you said earlier that you could have chemistry with someone that you choose not to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't have that choice point till they do. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes. It's very difficult. It's very difficult. Yeah. I think that it's really just about, I want to encourage people to have some discernment when they are choosing a partner, and that to realize that when we are going through that experience of lust in the beginning, we're a little crazy. Yeah. You know, we're seeing things through rose-colored glasses, and that it's just important to recognize that if, you know, because this is very specifically, if you keep repeating the same patterns and you really want to improve the relationship that you're in, or you're someone who keeps getting hurt by people and you really want to change your love life, this is what this book is for. And it might seem obvious, oh yeah, lust is not the same thing as love, but the things that are most obvious are usually the things that people get the most confusion about. And it's actually not that obvious, because because to love someone is really, you're making choices to be loving. It's like you said, it's like, okay, I'm not going to follow these accounts because ask myself, is this what's honoring the sacredness that I have between me and my wife? Right? So that's you choosing to love your wife and choosing to protect your relationship. That's a choice. That's a choice that you're making. Lust is not about choice. Lust is all feeling. And it can hijack our entire nervous system, and it can hijack our entire thinking mind, our rationality. And it's just not the same. And what happens is that when people transition out of the like, oh my God, you know, I met this perfect person, and we project the ideal onto this person, and we think this is the person with whom I'm going to be able to heal. This is the person who's going to heal all my childhood wounds. This is the person who's going to rescue me. We're not thinking this consciously, but this is really what's right. What we're doing. This is the projection. And then the relationship transitions from, you know, the insanity that is, you know, where we are, again, hijacked, our systems are hijacked by passion, by lust, by sex, by the excitement and then of something new, and the novelty wears off. And then we start to see, okay, this is a real person. They're flawed. They're actually not more evolved than I am. You know, they don't really have the capacity to understand me more than I am willing to actually explain myself. You know, they're not going to be able to finish all my sentences all the time. Then we start to think, oh God, I must not love them. Or, oh God, right. They must not be right for me. When really, no, what you're doing is you're coming out of the limerent stage of the falling in love, the lust and all of that. And then you are in reality. And now is when love can actually start to form. And so I don't want, you know, part of being a human being, you know, this fleeting experience as a human being in this world, because it goes by so fast, is to have these experiences. Like it's fun, and bring a little bit of your rational mind into this, and just realize that, like, just because you feel this way about this person, it doesn't mean that they're actually the right person for you. And it could be that you have a pattern of getting into these very lustful, intense scenarios with people, and you end up always getting hurt. So then you really need to be able to understand the difference between lust and love.
Yeah, there's a, my dad used to say to me that you don't have enough blood to perfuse to both your heads at the same time.
That's a good one. I like that.
It's so good. And I think what you said is so important, that discernment between, like, you don't have to go towards where you experience chemistry. And I think what a lot of people make the mistake of is they mistake chemistry as compatibility. Mm. And then that becomes, you know, like you said, if you keep going in these deeply lustful, like intense relationships that are very much captured by that limerence, and also I always think of the documentary, The Tinder Swindler, where it's like one person gets totally captured and the other one becomes the friend.
Right.
And it's like, we all have engaged with love bombing narcissists at some point. Like, we'll be exposed to them, especially, which is really fascinating, is like with the change of behavior, call it from the birth control pill, call it from culture, that women now really can select whether they are vulnerable to pregnancy and select ovulation, which that's never been done by a mammal. So pretty fascinating, but it changes mating strategies. And people who are narcissistic and psychopathic and sociopathic are more successful at short-term mating strategies. So we expose ourselves to that type of person more so. And if we don't have access to groundedness and being rooted in choice, because we can all be exposed to them, but some of us end up in relationships with them. Mm-hmm. And if it's, I would say it's always begins from chemistry. So if you can't, because you throw your brain in the garbage when you're deeply attracted to someone. I remember listening to Alison Armstrong say, like, never date someone where the attraction level is at 10 out of 10.
Yeah, I know. Like,
that's such bad advice. I remember thinking that. Mm-hmm. But then when I started to mature and learn more, I was like, that's actually incredible advice.
Yeah, it's incredible advice. But I would also argue that as we mature, what we find attractive changes. Mm-hmm. So we're not as attracted to the things that might harm us, but what we are attracted to is, you know, someone's value system or the way their character and the way that they carry themselves and whatnot. But, you know, at the same time, that physical, and there's so many different levels of chemistry, but yeah, if you are feeling like out of control, attracted to someone, you better not be sleeping with them until you really know you're in a relationship with them and you know a little bit about their value system and their character, because this, we just can't trust ourselves.
Right. Like, I think if you are open to considering it on a spiritual level too, you're sharing deep energetic experiences when you do that. And, you know, I think when I used to drink and have more casual relationships, it was really just a couple shadows hooking up in the night, you know, like two people's shadows. I often wondered, like, smoothness went way out the window. And I'm like, we clearly were, you know, because it's like two people's wounds are interacting. And when lust is the thing that we are captured by, I think about it of like, we're eroticizing our wounds, that that we have sex with someone who we don't feel fully chosen by. And then the arousal treats the pain of the rejection and the abandonment, which is projected onto them, but is really us abandoning our own being. And I don't, you know, I think that's probably one of the greatest opportunities for people to heal, you know? If you're listening to this podcast and you're thinking, I want to build those skills, I want to learn how to create epic love, I want to heal from a breakup, I want to heal my nervous system as I'm in the dating process so I can choose the most aligned partner to create a future with, well, I have the perfect opportunity for you. Because you're listening to the Create the Love podcast, you get to bypass the waiting list for the Create the Love community. You can go to createthelove.com/yes and get started with whichever course is most applicable to your life and the skill set you want to develop. And here's one thing I know for certain, is that great love can't wait. You have to get started right away. Your healing can't wait. So go register now at createthelove.com/yes and get started right away.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's also a lot going on. There's the, also the pressure of thinking, you know, how I will get this person is through our sexual connection. And, you know, I think that when it comes to sex, it's just important to really understand and know your psychology and know, like, do you get attached and what does sex mean to you? Because sex means something different for everyone. And what do you want it to mean to you? You know, if you've been hurt a lot and you want to enter a new relationship with a completely different sort of value system or blueprint, what do you want the sex to mean between you and someone you just met? What do you want it to represent for you?
Well, I think this really correlates so well to the invitation of what you're saying, of being able to be in discernment, of being able to hold back connection and sleeping with someone and getting captured by all the sex, and what you were saying about how what sex means for us and the experience we want to have with people.
Yes.
And yeah. And so into the next truth, I think it flows beautifully.
Which is?
Oh, I thought you were going to go with the next truth, which I think it flows into so beautifully, which is you have got to love your fucking self. You didn't say fuck, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. So this is one that I was very, it's probably the longest chapter, and it's one that has a lot of nuance. You know, there's two camps of thought. One is you learn to love yourself while in relationship, and that this idea that you have to be whole and fully love yourself before you enter a relationship is bullshit. And then there's another school of thought that says, no, you have to love yourself in order to be in a relationship. You have to love yourself in order to love another. You have to feel whole. And I think that I really think that it's somewhere in the middle.
This idea
that we have to be 100% healed and feel whole in order to be in a relationship, is the most depressing theory I've ever heard. I mean, then we're all just doomed. And I mean, we really are. We're just doomed. And so I find that very depressing. And I also find it very untrue. Very untrue. But also this idea that your self-worth and the way that you feel about yourself has no relevance about is also a ridiculous thing to say. Yes, it's true that we do learn, we gain our sense of self and we learn how to love ourselves and we can raise our self-esteem when we're in the relationship and we're doing the work and we're loving and receiving love. And, you know, there's going to be people who, you know, if you are smart enough, you're going to choose the person who sees in you beauty that you've never been able to see in yourself, you know, and is going to actually make you fall in love with yourself in some way. You know, they're going to reflect back to you your brilliance sometimes, you know. But the way a person feels about themselves really determines how they choose a partner. And it also determines who they're going to, what their boundaries are going to be in terms of how they're treated. And so many of the problems, maybe most of the problems that I've seen in people in relationships boils down to their self-worth. So mm-hmm. It's incredibly important that you love yourself enough to truly recognize that you are someone worth being loved. And so I think the way I see it is more just sort of self-acceptance and being able to say, you know, there's things that I am still working on and there's things that I'm well aware of the parts of me that are difficult and insecure and, you know, it takes a tremendous amount of confidence and paradoxically self-acceptance to enter a relationship or to be in relationship and really be honest with yourself about the ways in which you might sabotage or the ways in which you might be kind of difficult to live with. And I think that's important. But you learn to accept yourself and to hold yourself in high regard in spite of the fact that you're not perfect. Self-esteem is very important in a relationship. And people with low self-esteem in relationships, they don't speak up. They are doormats. They get in their heads a lot. They will project a lot and want the other partner to fix them or to rescue them. And then people with high self-esteem, you know, where they're grandiose, you know, on the narcissistic level, we know already what that does to a relationship. So it is really important to accept yourself and to hold yourself in high regard. In spite of the fact that you're not perfect, this is actually very, very important. And yes, it continues when you're in a relationship. And no, you don't have to feel perfect about yourself in order to be in a relationship. But you have to be working with something here. And if you deplore yourself and you're constantly putting yourself down and you can't stand yourself or you don't believe that you're lovable, better believe you're going to be sabotaging left and right. And you're going to be tolerating a whole lot of bullshit from other people. So it's relevant.
Yeah, that balance is, yeah, I totally agree with you. It's because even if you think you've, you know, I don't think there's necessarily a flaw to the pursuit of desiring whatever is quote unquote wholeness. And I think what you're saying is that if we believe we must be whole and complete and healed, we'll be fucking waiting forever to get into a relationship. Because once you enter a relationship, which I'm sure you hear this a lot, people are like, oh, I thought I healed that thing and then I got triggered. And it's like, yeah of course, because you weren't in a relationship. And so
yes, exactly.
Your relationship brings up all your shit. And so maybe it's about this delicate dancing on the edge of your self-worth, you know, that you have the humility to explore the trigger or the reactivity that is about reclaiming or taking up more space in terms of like becoming more and more, I don't even know if it's whole, but more expanded, you know, and, mm-hmm. and without relationship, you can't do that. So you're right. You know, it's like you have to, even thinking that you're whole and complete going into it, you won't have humility and curiosity, possibly, because you're like, I already did it. I already did the work. Yeah, you're the one who needs exactly. to do the work. This is your trigger, not mine.
I think what's more important is that people are able to find some level of peace being single. That doesn't mean that you give up your pursuit of being in a relationship, but you have to have some sense of fulfillment without the presence of a romantic relationship.
Yes.
Because then when you get into the romantic relationship and you have no sense of self and what makes you happy and what gives your life meaning, then the relationship and your partner becomes the only source. And then what's going to happen? You're just going to be incredibly disappointed. And this is when we enter relationships with very unrealistic expectations that the other person is actually meant to make you happy, when really they're not. But in the beginning, to tie this all into our conversation, or the larger picture of our conversation, you know, when we're in the lust phase, we truly believe like that person is the stimulus that is triggering inside of us a feeling of aliveness. And we're like waking up from this, like from sleepwalking. And we think, okay, then I must attach myself to this person, because without this person, I don't know how to feel this. And so now this person needs to love me exactly how they're loving me right now. They can't change. Nothing can change about our dynamic. And that's a real conundrum, because nothing stays the same. Everything changes. And they cannot make you feel this way all the time. They're just reminding you of something that you are capable of doing on your own. And it's not to say, look, there's something that a romantic relationship will give you that being alone won't. But we are all capable of accessing these feelings of oneness and completion. We feel it when we listen to our favorite music. We feel it when we're, I don't know, connecting with a pet or connecting with nature, whatever it is that really floats your boat. And so it's important to be able to meet these needs of ours, of our own, so that we don't put it all on our partner to make us happy. And lust gives us the illusion that we need this other person to feel this way. And it also gives us the illusion that it's permanent, that feeling is permanent.
Yeah. And I think this all beautifully woven in all these rules, these truths, how they just keep working together. But that even what you're saying is just speaking straight truth. And your next truth is that you got to speak up and tell the truth. And I think it coincides really with you need to be your best self even after the honeymoon, because what you're saying is, if I hear you correctly, and I obviously want you more clarity, the speak up and tell the truth is near and dear to my heart. I think it's like the essence of relationship is like, can you tell the truth no matter what, you know, because even your ambivalence or your fear is actually so relevant to the material for the relationship. And I think we can get caught in, because at the very beginning of the relationship, we're like presenting our best selves. And I remember Dan Savage, the like very famous relationship columnist. Yes. I remember him saying, we have to strive to be our best lie selves.
Because our best lie selves.
Yeah. Because at the beginning of a relationship, you're like lying about everything.
you're the ambassador of you, basically.
Yeah. So yeah, tell us a bit about both of those, like speaking up and telling the truth, and then really striving to maintain that level of standard.
Well, in my marriage that ended after 2 years, I realized that I wasn't telling the truth. And it wasn't that I was lying, and I was lying about my experience. I was so terrified of rocking the boat because I did not want to be left. I didn't want the relationship. I didn't want to be abandoned. I didn't want the relationship to end. So I withheld very important truths. And probably even more importantly, I didn't tell the truth to myself. I lied to myself constantly. And we do that. We lie to ourselves more than anyone will ever lie to us. And so speaking up and telling the truth is, I found to be so important, because if you can't, if you have to lie or silence yourself to preserve the relationship, there's something wrong with the relationship.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, worked with many couples where they're just afraid to tell the truth of their experience on something, because, you know, the truth will set you free, but sometimes it can really shake things up, and that's very scary. That's very scary. But I also know that no relationship can survive, thrive, improve, deepen if we're not actually saying our truth and telling the truth of what it is that we're experiencing. And so that can be a very scary thing for people to do. You know, they might be really good at telling the truth in their friendships or in other relationships, but when it comes to their romantic relationship, you know, we can become very withholding. We can conceal a lot, and we can get very caught up in micromanaging emotions and their emotions and our emotions, and micromanaging the status quo of the relationship. And we don't want to, you know, rock it. But if we're not saying something that's very important, if we're not talking about what it is that we're feeling or what our needs are, or, hey, you know, like we're not getting along and we're just kind of brushing it under the rug, and the elephant in the room is getting bigger and brighter and we're just not addressing it. And that's a recipe for disaster. And so I understand how incredibly scary it is, and I certainly don't want to encourage, you don't want to be having, you know, serious conversations about your relationship morning, noon, and night. That's a real drag. But you have to be able, like, the truth is what actually maintains a relationship, and you can't, and you have to really address the elephant in the room. And if you don't, then there's just a lot of resentment. There's a lot, then the mind, we get in the mind and we are creating stories, and we erode the relationship erodes without the truth. And so I wanted to highlight that, and then also give scripts of different scenarios in how you would actually express the truth. And why it's so important, because we have the hard conversations are really in service of the relationship. And I think that, you know, one of the most powerful reframes for me was, okay, if we can stop thinking about what's right for me or what's right for you, and we can think about what's right for the relationship, like what's going to make the relationship stronger. We have the hard conversations for that. And let's just say you're even in a dating scenario. Sometimes having the hard conversation is talking about sex, or is talking about what it is that you want in a relationship that might lead to a conversation where the two of you decide that you're not right for each other. These very difficult things, they require a lot of courage. They require a lot of bravery, but they are ultimately going to lead you down the right path. And by not speaking the truth, you're going to go down the wrong path. And that, I feel very strongly about that.
Well, and it fits so perfectly with your other truth, which is you can't convince someone to love you.
No.
Because, you know, yeah, if you're not telling the truth on some level, you are avoiding not being quote unquote lovable or choosable.
Yes. And here's the thing. If you have to convince someone to choose you or to love you, and this is a very difficult thing but it's very, the truth will set you free. It's important. They already don't love you.
Right.
They already have not chosen you. Like, they're already gone. You shouldn't ever have to.
Yeah, and it's such a painful place to be in. You know,
and it's terrible.
Perpetuation of a wound. It's like, man, imagine if we just put down the pursuit of people who don't pursue us.
I know. Or like, let go of the person who really wants to exit the relationship, like really wants to, you know, they made that decision.
Right. And that's one of those really fierce truths that, you know, I think everyone, if you're going to couples therapy or you're exploring stuff, is like, the first question is, do you both want to be here? And if you're here, are you actually authentically committed, even at least part of you, to working through this?
Right.
Because, you know, you get so many couples where like one person is cheating, having an affair, and then they go to couples therapy and the other person is still having the affair. It's like, you know, if we could just tell the truth, like, I'm not interested, I'm going to go date or be with whatever, Samantha, is like, it's the most devastating truth, but you're living it anyways.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's very toxic to the human body, to our physiology, to maintain knowing lies, like to actually maintain an untruth and try to protect the world from I mean, look at when people hold secrets, the toxicity to the body is just incredible, you know?
Yeah, no, it's very, very, very intense. And it's also like, it's the whole people pleasing thing. You don't want to disappoint someone, you know? And if you don't want to disappoint them, you don't actually tell the truth. And it's a sticky web. Yeah. So I really, that was a very important truth for me to write.
Yeah. It's a powerful one. I think it's one of the most liberating ones when we actually claim it. And I think it again, weaves perfectly with truth 8, which is no one's coming to save you.
Yeah.
And there's a beautiful grief to that, almost like a maturation process that has to happen even with sitting with the reality of that one.
Yes. And I think it's something that people need to kind of sit with it a lot. It's that your partner's not responsible for your happiness. And if you're single, there isn't, and you're, let's say you're a romantic, or you've been fantasizing about the knight in shining armor coming in, or the person coming in and completely changing your life. You know, there's, you know, the movie that comes to my mind, and I reference it in the book, is, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but 500 Days of Summer. Did you ever see 500 Days?
Yeah.
It's a great movie. And that's a perfect example. Like, so, on the outside, it looks like, oh, here's this really nice guy and this totally avoidant woman who's like, you know, mean to him. When really it's not that. It's he's depressed. He meets this person, and I think that the filmmaker purposely didn't give her much dimension. We don't really know her only through the eyes of him. Mm-hmm. So we can't really say that she's avoidant. It's just that that's his experience of her, because she was the trophy, and she was the one who was going to awaken him out of his pathetic life of like no meaning and no purpose and not having the courage to like actually pursue the work that means something to him. And she comes into his life, and, you know, like, he's rescued. And then he realizes, like, you know, she's not so into him. And then she leaves, and he feels like he has nothing. I mean, it's a good ending, because I think that, you know, being that, you know, he does end up pursuing, you know, the work of architecture and whatnot, and, you know, maybe her being in his life kind of like stimulated that thought. And so it's a great ending, but it's a perfect example of, you know, this idea that someone else can come into your life and take away all your problems. And it's just not true. In the beginning, it feels that way when you're in the fantasy, when you're in the lust, but it's not sustainable. And so, I think that, again, this is one of those things where people might be able to intellectually say, oh yeah, of course, like, no one's coming to save me. But okay, yes. But then look at your patterns, and look at the history of your love life, or look at how you operate inside of a relationship, if you're in a relationship. And how many times do you have the expectation that this person is actually supposed to fulfill you? and actually supposed to make you feel alive when this is something that you, when the onus is really on you.
Yeah, that what you said earlier too about how we get this experience of aliveness and then we associate aliveness with the person, not that they activated something within us that we just maybe have not activated. Mm-hmm. Much like that, the idea that you, when you are in relationship with someone who treats you really well and reflects to you your possibility and your potential and what you've been tolerating in your life, that it awakens in you the that you now are like, maybe I am worthy of something. And that's how you start healing because you're being treated well.
Yes.
And also that this person you've put on a pedestal that you're brought alive by, quote unquote, that all of a sudden you wake up to the feeling of flow states in other areas of your life, like pursuing passionate work.
Yes.
And I remember Carolyn Mace saying that if you were terrified of someone leaving you, if I was your angel, I'd have you fall in love with someone for 3 months and then have them leave you.
Mm.
Just so you could learn that's not actually the worst thing that can happen, that awakens within you that you need to complete yourself, that you need to step into yourself, that you need to pursue your passions, that you know. And it's like, I remember the first time I ever built something, I was taught my whole life that artists would never make money. And like, you can't make money doing that thing. And I remember I was so in flow doing it. I was like, wait, I'm actually good at this. I've spent 27 years believing that I couldn't paint things or build things. But it brought alive in me all these other aspects of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that recognition that someone leaves you so you recognize that your value doesn't live in them. That's like such a powerful.
It's extremely
worst
powerful.
Gift in the world.
Yeah, it's the word.
It's like, you know?
Yes. Yes.
The last truth, which
is a doozy.
Which I think will be great to leave people on the edge of, because if you're not convinced yet to buy the book, this is definitely going to convince you. It is a doozy. You must make peace with your parents.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more, Jillian.
Well, I put a disclaimer in the chapter just so people understand that if you've been molested or severely abused in some way, I don't expect you to make peace with your parents. I think that maybe you should never speak to them ever again. And my work with people who've experienced something along those lines is to help them recognize that they're a hero and not just a survivor. Also, making peace with your parent doesn't mean that you actually have to have a relationship with them. It doesn't mean that they even have to be alive. And making peace with your parent could also mean that you could love your parent and have a good relationship with them, but making peace could be you living your life the way that you want to live versus the way that you've always thought that they wanted you to live it. So sort of that sort of emancipation from the story that you have about your relationship with your parent that has imprisoned you and therefore has been in very much showing up in your romantic life. Because when we have this sort of unfinished business with our parent and we have a story around that, what happens is that it does show up in our romantic relationships. And it doesn't, again, it doesn't mean that it has to be rainbows and unicorns, but I do talk about my relationship with my father who died a year ago. He died actually as I was writing this chapter, and he was narcissistic and bipolar, and he was a terrible dad by anyone's standard in many ways. And I was estranged from him for many years. So I felt very, qualified, to be honest, to be able to write this chapter, because I'm not asking people to do something that I haven't searched inside myself to be able to find as well. I went through this estrangement and then I realized, you know what, this is harder to be estranged. And I have to figure this out because I definitely don't want to be I don't want to be the girl with daddy issues. Like I don't want that to be defining for me. And I've had some great relationships where it didn't show up, but you know, it's always sort of there. And so the final frontier, so to speak, if you're wanting to heal something, is to understand the relationship that you have with your parents and to start to look at certain stories that may have a chokehold on you and to try to see it differently. And I outline, I get very detailed and very pragmatic in how one can actually start to do that.
That's so powerful. And I like that it's the last one because, you don't start with mom or dad, but I think once the layers of healing and recognizing, building skill sets, all those types of things, eventually we do come to the point of origin. And whether a parent is accessible or not, or much like you said, sometimes making peace with a parent is having no contact. And there is something so powerful about saying the thing from the point of origin of that we might be pursuing unavailable people because we have an unavailable father, for example.
Yes.
And so we say the thing to the people who are unavailable, and then we stand in a different way of relating. But to actually go back to where the wound originated is the deepest work. And also it really differentiates like the maturation process of becoming the adult. You're no longer the child in the wound with the parent. You're now the adult confronting the adult.
Yes.
Or perhaps child, because your parent can be pretty childish at some
point. Yeah. I mean, look, I do think that for me, real maturity is defined when we're speaking about parent-child relationships, is defined by we're finally able to acknowledge that our parents are having or have had a human experience just like we are.
Right. Right. And they're the children of parents too, you know, and that's, that's a big, when you can see the next layer above them of what conditioned them, which is not excusing anything.
Yeah. So exactly. And I think that we go through, you know, I think we go through two very confronting, but also liberating experiences. And one is my partner is not perfect. That discovery that my partner is flawed and, you know, fucked up too, just like I am, you know, whatever, has their stuff. And my parent is not the hero and is just a human too. And so our parent, you know, we want to see our partner very much the way that we wanted to see our parents, is sort of these superhumans that are going to love us unconditionally. And I think that these transitions from, oh, my partner is just another human being and my parent is just another human being, is equally disturbing and yet also the thing that's going to free us.
Beautiful. Jillian Turecki, I'm so excited that you wrote this book actually distilled all your brilliant knowledge into how many pages?
Oh, good question. I want to say it's a little over 250 pages, something like that.
Perfect. Well, for everyone listening, watching, go pick up Jillian's new book, It Begins With You. We'll put the link in the show notes. Jillian, where can people find all the things?
I mean, you just have to know the spelling of my first and last name, JillianTurecki.com/book. I have my podcast, Jillian on Love. I have my social media, Jillian Turecki. So that's how you find me.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time. And everyone, go buy this book.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate you.
Of course. You're welcome.